Today, let's just look the other way. The DFA Daily to the 10th of September 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. The Age reports that Inner Melbourne is projected to lose 79,000 jobs annually and bleed more than $110 billion in revenue over the next 5 years as the COVID-19 recession savages the central city. New modelling predicts the Andrews government's decision last month to move from Stage 3 to Stage 4 restrictions will cost the city's economy $61 billion over 5 years, although the modelling did not take into account the economic or health impacts of a worsening pandemic. Job losses across Victoria have already far eclipsed the heights of the 1990s recession and are projected to hit almost 400,000 annually over 5 years. Accounting giant PwC conducted modelling for the City of Melbourne and the Victorian Government, showing the economic effects of the pandemic on Inner Melbourne will be far worse than the 1990s recession, equivalent to the combined impacts on the city of World War I and the Spanish flu pandemic. PwC forecasts statewide economic output will fall by $327 billion over the next 5 years compared to pre-COVID projections and says an average of 398,000 jobs will be lost each year over the next 5 years. It predicts the City of Melbourne's economy will contract by up to $23.5 billion this year or 22% of forecasted growth. PwC conducted its modelling amid a shifting pandemic and soaring coronavirus case numbers, and according to two scenarios presented in its full report, if Melbourne stayed in Stage 3 restrictions, the City of Melbourne would have faced a $49 billion shortfall in projected revenue over 5 years. Once Metropolitan Melbourne moved to Stage 4 restrictions, that projection ballooned to $110 billion in lost revenue. Australian Venue Co. Chief Executive Paul Watterson, who owns 42 Victorian hospitality venues, said his company would invest $30 million in refurbishing pubs in Queensland, but he predicted businesses would take an extremely cautious approach to capital allocation in Melbourne for some time. You tend to invest where you're going to get more certainty of the outcome, and unfortunately, that's not the Melbourne CBD at the moment, he said. Mr. Watterson believes people will stay away from the CBD even as Metropolitan Melbourne emerges from lockdown in coming months. When we were open after the first lockdown, many of the suburban venues were still within about 15 to 20% of what their normal revenue would be. And I think that was primarily because people were working at home, but the city venues remained 60 to 65% down. So there's a real two-speed recovery in Victoria. The city's economy last year totaled a record $104 billion, equivalent to 24% of Victoria's gross state product. Lord Mayor Sally Capp said the state and federal government should offer urgent financial assistance to the city. Melbourne was the economic powerhouse of Australia, and the scale of the economic shock being felt across the central city is unprecedented, she said. This new data shows that Melbourne needs urgent support from the Victorian and Australian governments to support businesses and restore our marvellous Melbourne. Almost 128,000 jobs were lost in April across the state, more than three times the 38,000 lost in March 1991, which was the largest single-month job reduction in Victoria in that recession. The PwC modelling predicts 22,900 jobs will be lost in Melbourne's accommodation and food services sectors alone this year, equivalent to $1.99 billion in foregone revenue. Under the government's plan to leave lockdown, hospitality businesses will be able to reopen for limited dining and retailing businesses from October the 26th if the 14-day COVID-19 case average has fallen to five or fewer, with no more than five cases of an unknown origin. A spokesman said the Andrews government had already announced more than $10 billion in assistance for businesses, workers and families, and hinted there was more to come. There's no escaping the steep economic costs of the coronavirus. This is the case right around the world, and Victoria is not immune, he said. We are carefully considering what further economic support measures are necessary, and we will have more to say in due course. The Australian Retailers Association Chief Executive Paul Zara said traders would endure 16 weeks of continuous lockdowns. Restrictions have hit CBD retailers like a sledgehammer, and they have felt the pressure more than other locations under the weight of lost foot traffic and elevated rents, he said. We are calling on the Victorian government to reconsider the stage reopening timelines for retail, given its exemplary safety performance, and to identify more realistic daily caseload targets. As our understanding of the virus improves globally, it is increasingly clear we are now living with COVID, and an elimination strategy is unlikely for many years. PwC's research shows the higher education sector, highly reliant on international students, has already lost 6,800 jobs in Victoria, equivalent to 25% of the workforce. It says that for every dollar lost in higher education fees, an additional $1.5 is lost to the broader economy from student spending. Tourism is another sector in which revenue all but dried up overnight. PwC says that in the year to March, 9.5 million international and domestic visitors flocked to Victoria. Those tourists spent about $31.3 billion, equivalent to about $85.6 million per day, with Greater Melbourne drawing about 40% of the visitors. The PwC modelling assumes a slow economic recovery from the pandemic and public health measures being in place into next year. And Domain reported that Australia had suffered a $20 billion slump in major project approvals since the coronavirus crisis began, shrinking the pipeline of new construction. At the same time, political leaders claim their infrastructure plans will boost growth, according to data from Infrastructure Partnerships Australia. A new industry analysis warns the value of major contracts being awarded fell to $6.7 billion in the first 8 months of this year, down from $27.1 billion approved last year. The slowdown has sparked fears that construction work will stall when the economy is struggling to emerge from recession and the federal government is phasing out its JobKeeper wage subsidy for more than 3.5 million workers. But this is a legacy of poor policy over recent years, with a focus on migration-led, property-led growth, supported by higher debt rather than a proper national growth plan. So what are the chances the upcoming October budget will change course despite all the words about job creation? Well, all I say is don't hold your breath. The ABS reported that total filled jobs fell by 6.4% and hours worked fell by 9.8% between the March and June quarters. The Labour account is the best source of headline information on employment by industry and sector, drawing on the broad range of labour market statistics the ABS produces. It contains a range of key indicators for jobs, people, hours worked, and labour income back to September 1994. And they said the labour account provides the most comprehensive measure of total job losses during the COVID-19 period, a fall of around 932,000 jobs. This echoes what we've seen previously in falls in employment in labour force survey data and changes in jobs in the index payroll data. The record decrease in filled jobs followed a small decrease of 0.1% in the March quarter. The decrease between March and June was more pronounced in the private sector, down 7.1%, compared to the public sector, down 1.9%. The number of secondary jobs in the labour market decreased by 19.6%, and the rate of multiple job holding fell to 4.9% of all employed people from around 6% prior to the COVID-19 period. The number of job vacancies decreased by 42.1% over the quarter and was down 43.3% on June 2019, and vacant jobs accounted for 0.96% of all jobs in the June quarter, the lowest since March 2002. In line with the impact seen in other indicators, the largest declines in hours worked since the March quarter were in the accommodation and food services industries, down 36%, and the arts and recreation industries down 35.5%. And over in New Zealand at interest.co.nz, Greg Ninnis asked whether the suggestion that house prices double every 10 years is an urban myth or fact. Of course, I've already discussed the doubling in 7 years in a recent post in Australia. But he says it's a phrase that's often quoted, particularly by people with an interest in promoting property as an investment. Unfortunately, he says the answer is a resounding that depends. Between June 2010 and June 2020, the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand's median selling price increased from $352,000 to $639,000, an increase of 81.5%. So that's the median. It's an indicator of where the middle of the market is. But what about the bottom end of the market that's generally of more interest to investors and first-time buyers? Well, over the same 10-year period, the lower quartile selling price increased from $253,000 to $452,000, up just 78.7%. That suggests that the bottom and mid-price segments of the residential property market both increased at a similar pace over the last 10 years, and that prices increased overall by around 80%. Not quite the 100% that's required for a doubling of prices, but not all that far off either. By the way, these are not inflation adjusted, so the real numbers will of course be lower. So would it be more accurate then to say that house prices more or less doubled every 10 years? Well, looking more closely at the figures, there were some big regional variations. The regions with the lowest median price gains over the decade were Canterbury and Westland, up 43.4%, Taranaki, up 47.4%, while the biggest increases were in Otago, up 111.5%, and Auckland, up 107.1%. The other regions with gains above 90% were the Bay of Plenty and Hawke's Bay at 98.8% and 91.5% respectively. Similar regional trends were evidence for lower quartile prices. So he said, would it be fair to say that house prices in some regions double every 10 years? Well, perhaps, but again, it depends, because as well as big regional differences in price growth, there were also big timing differences. If you look at what happened in the 5 years from June 2010 to June 2015, and then from June 2015 to 2020, two very different trends emerge. In the first half of the decade, from 2010 to 2015, median prices rocketed up in Auckland, gaining 71.9% over the 5 years. But around the rest of the country, median price growth was more subdued, with just one region, Canterbury and Westland, achieving price growth above 20%. At 29.1%. In four regions, median price growth was either negative or negligible, including Hawke's Bay down 1.7% and Wellington down 2.5%. But in the second half of the decade, from June 2015 to June 2020, the price trends reversed. Auckland's median price growth slowed to 20.5%, and growth rates in other regional centres rocketed up, with the biggest increase occurring in Hawke's Bay, up 94.8%, and Waikato, up 82%. What the figures do suggest is that residential property prices rise over the long term, but the rate of growth can vary wildly, and there are maybe even times when property prices do go down. So, he says, are property prices likely to double again over the next 10 years? Well, unfortunately, the answer is the same as before. That depends. The likelihood is that there will be some properties that double in value over the next 10 years, but there could be just as many that don't. With so many economic uncertainties swirling over the market, the real estate crystal ball has probably never been as cloudy as it is at the moment. And just to remind you again, if you wanted to correct for inflation, then the results would be considerably lower. But in contrast to the RBA over in New Zealand, the RBNZ, who handles both monetary and prudential policy, with 20% of the staff of the RBA and APRA, are leading on macroprudential policies for years, while here in Australia, they're just panicking at the housing bubble. Remember that the RBNZ led on financial stability, forcing Australian banks to hold more higher capital than Australian parents to ensure taxpayers are not exposed to poor lending practices. And they led the way during the COVID-19 crisis, and now the Reserve Bank of New Zealand has pioneered discussion around negative interest rates for New Zealand. It did so aggressively and early after markets began to recover from March. The day may or may not come, but the three-year bond yesterday flipped negative for the first time. So now the New Zealand government is getting money for free as international investors buy in. Read and learn, RBA. Read and learn. And meanwhile, in a parallel universe, APRA changed the rules some more to reduce the appearance of aging. Sorry, I mean the appearance of mortgage defaults, but I guess the principles are pretty much the same. It was all in a letter sent to the banks yesterday. The changes include provisions covering loans subject to more than one restructure and the extension of concessional capital treatments to loans to other legal entities. And it's also changed its reporting requirements, making them less onerous on smaller ADIs. The regulator released its response to submissions from authorised deposit-taking institutions on the formalisation of its proposed temporary adjustments to the prudential standard covering credit quality. That's APS 220. APRA wrote to ADIs in March saying lenders that offered borrowers impacted by COVID-19 an option to defer payments for a period of up to 6 months may not treat the repayment deferral period as a period of arrears for capital adequacy and regulatory reporting purposes. And in July, they wrote to APRA again, saying that the regulatory adjustments will be extended until March next year. And it also said that where an ADI restructures an affected borrower's facility before the 31st of March next year, with a view to putting the borrower on a sustainable financial footing, the loan may continue to be regarded as a performing loan for capital and regulatory reporting purposes. And in its latest communication, it's removed in a requirement that loans may only be restructured once, saying in extreme circumstances, such as in the event of further lockdowns or further restrictions on activity, additional restructuring may be appropriate. And it also clarified the rule on counting arrears. An ADI may reset the arrears count to zero, where it modifies the loan to adjust for the deferral period and any existing arrears, specifically where an ADI extends the maturity or increases repayments over the remaining loan term to adjust for prior missed repayments, arrears can be reset to zero. He said, hallelujah. APRA has extended concessional capital treatment beyond loans to retail and small business customers to also cover other legal entities such as trusts with less than 10 million Aussie dollars of outstanding debt. And to relieve the pressure on small ADIs, it's increased the reporting threshold from $10 million in total loans subject to repayment deferral to $20 million. But APRA did say that it would stick to its 31st of March 2021 deadline for returning the prudential framework to normal, saying it's important that ADIs are proactive in transitioning borrowers through this period of disruption and there is a timely and orderly return to the normal functioning of the framework. Of course, they'll change that later. Anything to keep the Ponzi scheme running a bit longer. And meantime, Fitch Ratings warns that they expect to see higher arrears ahead and that it will hit the retail mortgage-backed security portfolios. And they think home prices will fall a bit, but not as much as in 2017 to 2019, which is jolly convenient. Just remember that any loans over 90 days in arrears are regarded as being in default, and it increased it up to 0.61% from 0.57% last time. And they expect the default rate to rise after the first quarter of 21, once payment holidays end, due, they say, to the deteriorating macroeconomic conditions caused by the pandemic. But then APRA will simply shift the goalposts again. This is moral hazard on steroids, pure and simple. And of course, don't forget that ASIC has already basically given up on responsible lending, so the banks can lend until the pips squeak. This is all rather concerning insofar that we are just building a bigger problem for later. And as I discussed yesterday, the credit volumes did increase last month. Well, in fact, new credit did. But the real truth, and the thing that's not really being discussed, is that people are paying down their loans big time because of the uncertainty ahead, and I think that's a very, very smart move. So given that things are definitely on the slide and will continue for some time, the right strategy for many people will be to reduce their debt. Never mind what the regulators say. Never mind what the Reserve Bank says. Because at the end of the day, the debt that you hold stops with you as an individual household. And in Australia, of course, there is full recourse, meaning the buck truly stops with each individual borrower. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.